Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Breaking Point Podcast UK. Today, we're here with George Carnell, a fellow podcaster. And George has got quite an upsetting story, but also incredibly commendable and inspiring. So, George, why don't you tell people what, give an introduction to yourself, how you seem fit?
Yeah, so first of all, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Of course.
I guess the best way to sort of introduce myself is, so I'm 24 now, and I've been suffering my mental health for the past three and a half years. Back in May 2020, during lockdown, I was one of those that you would hear me before you see me. I was always out socializing, always with friends, always with family. And lockdown just seemed like I was trapped in this situation where everything that I was enjoying was taken away. There was no freedom. And I just struggled massively with it. And I woke up one morning and I was reading something and I just rubbed my head like a normal action, and I felt a lump, and I had no idea where it had come from. It was quite like a significant lump, so I went down to the local pharmacy and they asked me if it was through trauma, so if I'd banged it during the night, if something had hit me on the head, and I was adamant nothing had happened. And then at that point I started losing the vision in my left eye. So immediately they was like, right, go to St. Mary's Hospital because we have no idea what this is. Went to St. Mary's straight away. Obviously, like, my anxiety was sky high at this point. So I've gone to St. Mary's and they was asking me questions, same questions. Was it trauma? Had I banged it? I was like, no. And so obviously during lockdown, my mum had to wait outside. She couldn't come in with me.
Yeah.
And I was sat there and they said, oh, from how you're describing and your symptoms, it could be a brain hemorrhage. Now, I didn't know what a brain hemorrhage was at this point. So, like people do, I just got my phone and I Googled what a brain hemorrhage was, which is probably a big mistake, because then I started reading what it was. And at this point, I was sort of fearing for my life. So I've gone back into the room and they explained that they was going to put dye in my arm to so they could check what was actually going on. And I was having an MRI scan. And it's strange. Like, I've got tattoos, needles are fine in that sense, but you try and take my blood or any needles in that sense and I'm no doubt all the time. So as they was telling me, I fainted on the spot in the room.
Wow.
So me being me, I basically cried for my mum. And so my mum came in, who was able to explain what was going on. They put me in a wheelchair and took me to the MRI room. And they basically turned around and said they had no idea what it was. It wasn't a brain hemorrhage. They cleared that up straight away. However, they couldn't attempt to drain it because the pressure could make me blind. So they said, look, go home. And we'll monitor over 24 hours. If it's that bad still, come back up and we'll get you to back up to the eye department. So I've gone home and I kid you not, I was laid there on the sofa with a pillow under me, laid on top, and then I had to squeeze another pillow on top because the pain, it was like my head was being crushed. Phoned up, mum phoned up and said, look, he's in a bad way, we got to come back. So at this point, I'll send you the file as you see it. The next day, the lump had moved to the center of my head. So I'm thinking, if it's going to keep moving, I thought it was going to start coming like down and something was going to come out of me. Going back out, and this doctor just prodded me a couple of times, had a film, went, just go home, relax, don't do nothing physical, just relax, you'll be fine. I was like, sorry, mate, like, did it again. I was like, the first doctor said this, and they also had me to just go home and relax. And then long story short, after a couple of days, the lump had gone and there was nothing come out of me, no fluid. And went back and they said it was a stress lump. So your body would give you signs that you're stressed. But at this point, the anxiety, the stress that I was under with what was going on, the lockdown plus this lump, I just woke up and on the 13th of May, woke up in the morning, mum had gone to work because she was a carer, so she was still working. It was just me and my younger brother in Dawes, and he's severely autistic, so he needs full-time care. So I woke up in the morning and something just went, and I went, that was it. Today's the day I'm going to kill myself. I was tired of being in pain, tired of hurting. So I wrote a suicide note out that probably would have took about 10 minutes to read. Posted it on my social media, like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, just to say goodbye. Locked the front door, turned my phone off, took 23 antidepressants, and I was out on the floor. Only what I was told, obviously, next point I woke up, I was in the hospital bed, but my auntie has broke through the door, like got through the window, unlocked the door. And she said there was about 50 people all outside the house, mates, family, people that I didn't even know that I just had on social media, there to try and help. Went to hospital and they just asked me, like, did you want to die? And I said, in that moment, yes, I did. But I'm just tired of being in pain. I don't want to die. I just want the pain to stop. So that was a tough moment. And like, even now, so I don't forgive myself for the fact it was just my brother in Dawes, because there was no way he could pick up a phone or seek help or even help me. It's a place where you can't see any way out. And the way I described it was like, when you close your eyes, like, you have thoughts about anything. And I couldn't think of anything. It was just black. Like, my whole thoughts and my mind was just black. It was like I was in a black hole. That's all, no way out of. So, but the changing point for me was my great nan. She had FaceTimed me whilst I was in hospital and said, when I see you, I see granddad. Now, he's the only person we've lost in our life. She said, when I look at you, I see granddad. I've lost him once. I'm not losing him twice. And
yeah,
I was just taken back. It knocked me for six, and then there was like a kick up the backside where it was like, by ending my temporary pain, I was putting permanent pain on everyone else. So I just sort of had to switch up and just try and work on myself. And 3.5 years down the line, we're in a place now where I can say that I'm happy and I'm in love with the person that I look at in the mirror now.
And that's the main thing. Yeah. I think it's also important to, me and you are the same age. And in lockdown, you would have been, were you 20?
Yeah, 20, yeah.
During that lockdown period? Yeah, 20. So me too. And 20 is a difficult age. Well, that whole sort of late adolescence, early adulthood is difficult. But especially as you said, how you're an incredibly extroverted person.
Mm.
Like for me, I'm a lot more introverted in many ways, so I wasn't as bothered by the whole lockdown some of the time. But if you've, you know, to go from the lifestyle that you, I imagine you were living, to have it all taken away like that. I know some people who have been in similar situations and they really struggled. And you're right, it is, you know, it's like you fall into an abyss, isn't it? And you can't see any way out. And it's amazing how, I was thinking about this the other day, I think like the way we see the world in stories. Mm. And there are certain stories that are more powerful than others. And incredibly powerful stories are like archetypes. And an archetype is like a story that's been repeated over and over and over again. So that it's like, not to us, but to our ancestors, so that it's kind of our brains have evolved to almost be receptive to the story. And depression and anxiety are obviously stories, and it's amazing how when we can get caught up in that story of like incredibly low mood and we fall into the abyss and the black hole, we get stuck and we can't actually see the world how it is. We see the world how we see the world through the lens of the story. And that's incredibly to separate out those things is an incredibly difficult path. And yeah, and I feel like one of the questions that I ask everyone is, what was their breaking point? Hence the name of the podcast. And obviously we know what your breaking point was. And what was life like after that moment? And how did you respond to the reaction that you got? Because that must have been quite a surprising reaction of the way everyone reacted.
So when I woke up in hospital, I had, and I'll kid you, I must have had near on 800 messages across social media of people reaching out, asking me if I was all right, just messages like from the time I'd put a suicide note out, like people just messaged me from that point saying, please don't do it, like I'm here, tell me where you are, I'll come and see you. But I think the overriding feeling, I was a little bit embarrassed. In the sense of I'd been a little bit, I was a bit selfish in the sense of I now know what I would have caused everyone if I hadn't been safe. But I think life after that, I had to prove to myself that that wasn't the answer, and there's other avenues that you can take that can benefit you and your mental health and your well-being, and you don't have to take it upon yourself to do that journey. There is that support there. You just have to reach out, because no one knows what people are feeling just by looking at them, because we all put this front on, and it's only until you have a deep conversation with someone that you realize how broken they are. I got involved with United Minds, this was February 21. So this was about 7-8 months. So I'd done a load of private counseling and therapy, and it didn't work for me. I couldn't take to being sat across the table from someone whose profession it was, because I felt judged and I just felt like another person. And that's nothing against them. It was just that was just my personal experience and how I was feeling. And a couple of lads reached out to me and said, look, we've got this group called United Minds that we've set up, which is for men who are suffering. And we've organised a game, a football game, that is. Do you want to get involved? I said, yeah. I said, okay, why not? Look, I love football. Like, I've always played football my whole life. And I went there and I did not say a single word. So didn't speak to anyone. I was just a shy, anxious, confused person. And so I got involved on that level, and it's just grown and grown. I think we had about 12 lads out of the 18 that played, 12 of the lads had suffered, and they just got people in to sort of help out in terms of numbers. And then now we went on this journey with them that it just seemed to grow and grow. And I think within the last 3 years, mental health's become this subject where there seems to be more people talking about it, which is excellent, which is what they should be doing. But it's showing that vulnerability that, look, this is what we all went through. You might have experienced what you might be experiencing now, what we've been through. So we can put our hand out and say, look, you're not alone in what you're feeling. So don't fight your own demons in your mind. And look, now we have 140 blokes involved. We've just put in our paperwork to become a charity. And like now I'm a board member, so I've just gone through this transition of self-work, self-discipline, put myself back through the trauma to work out exactly why I got to that point. And like now, like my habits now and what I do now compared to what I was doing back then is just completely different.
Yeah. We'll talk about what's the charity called again? Sorry.
United Minds.
United Minds. Yeah. We'll talk about them in a minute. I just want to come back to something when that we use the word selfish to describe yourself in that moment. And I think that's too being too harsh on yourself, really. I think people don't get to that point, you know, on a whim or on a sort of random. Things have to get really, really bad. And as we've already discussed, we fall into an abyss, and we fall into an abyss where we see nothing other than the darkness around us. And to use the word selfish isn't accurate, but you're being too judgmental. I think I completely understand where you were, and I completely understand how you feel now, and how I think the best thing that you've done and you're doing is you're reflecting on that moment and how you got there, which is the most important thing.
Yeah, I'll agree with you there and what you just said. I don't think I'm talking selfish in terms of that it's wrong to feel like that's your option. I think it was just if I could talk to that person back then, I would say, like, you're not in this alone. I just wish I had that knowledge back then that you don't have to take that way out of ending your pain. There's other remedies and coping mechanisms that you can implement that will help you if you ever get to that point. Yeah.
And it's an interesting sort of, why is it one of the main things people say when they talk about struggling with mental health is they say they feel alone, and that sort of it gives a clue as to how much we need to be around other people and to how much the community that we're embedded in is vital to our livelihood. We often kind of think that our sanity is internal and it's to do with ourselves, but actually I think a lot of it is a result of the people around us and the actions that we engage in. And as a 20-year-old man nowadays, there's plenty of temptation to, I can imagine, engage in certain behaviors that would not be conducive or helpful to having good mental health. So I think you might have mentioned something about you were doing things that you knew you shouldn't have been doing or that weren't helping you. Can you go into some of those with as much as you feel comfortable?
Yeah, so like, I was, you know, that age, I was always out. As soon as it got to Friday, my first thinking was, it's Friday, finish work, get ready, down the pub. And then ends up in the kitchen till ridiculous o'clock. But the one thing I learned was when I was going through that transition, that it's also about who you surround yourself with. And I learned that I had to be around people that was making me a better person and wanted me around for being me and not the person I was when I was drunk and basically out of my face. And if I had asked them people, instead of going to a pub on Friday, if I had asked them, do you fancy going for a walk and getting a coffee? I'm pretty sure they would have said no, because it didn't involve getting drunk and the behaviours that followed. So that's the one thing I've learned. Like, I lost my friendship group when I was going through that period. I was lonely. But now I'm with people that I know that if I picked up the phone at a time of need and I was struggling, they wouldn't hesitate to be there.
Yeah, and that's the main thing. I think in the modern era, so many people, the number of people that we could call in a crisis outside family is, you know, it's getting less and less and less, and it has been getting less and less over the past 50 years or so. And I think the modern way of living has got a lot to do with that. We've had things sort of stripped away from us to then be sold back to us for profit. And yes, you are right. Being around people who like you is hard, because to what degree are relationships sort of like, you give me this and I give you that, and then we're sort of, it's more, if you stop giving someone something, do they remain friends with you? And in some ways that's too harsh, because ultimately we are humans and we have desires and needs, and we're engaged in transactional relationships. But you got to find people, as you said, that want you to be who you are and not who they want you to be, but who you actually are. And that's really important.
And I think it's just about being able to be vulnerable with them as well. You want to be around people that you can be vulnerable, and it helps break that barrier of, like I keep saying, is keeping them that stuff inside that can then lead to them thoughts where it's just you and them thoughts. You've only got one perception on that thought. Whereas if you're talking about it and you're having them conversations, you'll get another perception where, again, like I say, and they might have experienced, and they might be able to say, look, I felt like that. Maybe think of it like this. And then it's like a light bulb goes off and you just suddenly have a different view of the situation.
Yeah. And that's another thing, going back to the whole sort of abyss. We're almost, even when we're not feeling depressed just in everyday life, we're almost always in our own black hole, which is the world is the way that we see it. We can't see it in many other ways. And that's why, as you said, you need to speak to other people, because they see things differently to how you do. And that's incredibly important, to get multiple perspectives of things, isn't it? So very, very true. Yeah. Can we talk about what was childhood like for you? What were you like growing up? Did you have to suffer from any difficulties?
Yeah, so with childhood, I was a bright kid. I'd done really well in school, and come away with good qualifications. We had just a typical working class family, like me and my younger brother, and I had two older sisters, and then my mum and dad. But when we got to 12, 13, New Year's Eve, me and my sister witnessed domestic violence between my mum and dad, where my dad had basically beaten my mum to the point where we didn't know she was still breathing. And at that age, I think you don't really process what's gone on. I never spoke at school about it. Obviously, no friends to talk to about it. Because I think at that age, how you even bring out that conversation is pretty difficult.
100%.
And we went through like six emergency accommodations. And I didn't really speak to my dad for probably about 2-3 years. So childhood as a whole was good, but the memory of childhood is just shadowed by that event and the trauma that came with it.
Yeah, I can only imagine how traumatic that must be, seeing two of the most important people in your life in that situation, and one treating the other one that way, and then having to sort of shoulder that at such a young age. So, and I hope that you've spoken about it to people who, and you've sort of, as you said earlier, you've gone back into the memory and taken out what you needed to take out of it. And hopefully that's not as troublesome for you anymore. But yeah, I can only empathize with how difficult that must have been.
The two things that I learned out of it was, where I hadn't spoken about it, maybe it had a delayed effect of the person I was at that age, like in terms of relationships, like I couldn't really stay in a relationship. And like my therapist my therapist at the time when I was talking about it, she said that it was like my life was like a Coke bottle, and these events and the trauma was like putting a Mento in every time, and I never took the cap off it.
Mm.
So what I've done is I've kept putting stuff in this Coke bowl to the point where it's just exploded because I never took the Mentos out.
Yeah.
And then talking about it, it made me realize that what I actually learned from that event was the type of person I didn't want to be. So I learned what exactly I would never do. Now I'll talk about it. When I talk about my experiences, I talk about it because I think it's important, because someone might be going through it that you don't know what people's home life is like, and someone might be going through it, and I think it's important to talk about it, because it, even though it's them that's going through the situation, it's also you as a child going through it as well, and it can have that delayed effect where it doesn't really take over your thoughts until a later age.
Yeah, it's an incredibly important thing to talk about, and you're absolutely right about how when things happen to us or we experience things at a young age, we can't make sense of it in the same way that an adult makes sense of it. We don't have A, our brains aren't developed properly, and B, we don't have enough knowledge of the world to understand what's going on and what that means, and therefore everything reflects back onto ourselves. And that's why a lot of victims blame themselves, because we haven't learned how to empathize. Maybe empathize is the wrong word, but haven't learned how to put ourselves outside of our own shoes as well as maybe an adult in theory could. And that's why you get victim blaming and things like that. And it's incredibly awful that is the default human way of thinking. But I guess that is the default human way of thinking a lot of the time. It's the same way as our negativity bias, how we're more likely to see the bad than see the good a lot of the time, because that's more important. Difficult.
Yeah, definitely.
Shall we? Yeah. Let's talk about George now, and let's talk about the podcast, and let's talk about some good things and, you know, bright things that are going on in your life. Tell us about a problem half.
Yeah. So the problem half podcast, basically I started it, June time, so only a couple of months ago, and basically that stemmed from being in United Minds, and where I was going through that period of self-work, self-development, and just got myself to a point where I could now deal with them bad days a lot better, and I was having open conversations, being vulnerable with other men, that I thought, let's give them a platform where we can break the stigma and put the conversations out there. So like I've said, if someone's going through what that lad is talking about on the podcast, they realize that it's okay to talk about them things, and they're not alone in what they're talking about. And I think you realize that like mental health is this umbrella, and there is so many things that come underneath it that are your mental health. We've had one lad has gone through 11 rounds of IVF, PTSD from serving in the army, mental health in football, drinking, drugs, addiction, that's now become a therapist. And that's just some of them. And you just realize that everyone has these different paths of life and different ages, but we've all still got mental health. And just by talking about it, and that's why it's called the A Problem Half podcast, is the saying I live by is, a problem shared is a problem halved. Because the minute you've spoken about it,
great name.
The weight that comes off your shoulders is just, it's pretty surreal.
No, it is pretty surreal. It's, and that goes back to the notion that I think you brought up earlier of how important it is just talking to people. And it doesn't even have to be finding a solution to the problem that you have. It can just be saying the problem that you have out loud. And sometimes that's just enough, because it means that it's just not rattling around in your head anymore. And A, it feels like someone else is able to take, absorb an element of your difficulty, but they don't have to feel it as such, because it's not actually impacting them. But they still can take some of it on away from you, and that's incredibly important. How many guests have you had on so far?
Originally we had started it on Spotify and we had 6, and then one of my good friends, Jack, he's our age and he has like a 9-to-5 job, but he does media on the side and he's brilliant at what he does. And he reached out to me and said, nice, how about we give the podcast another avenue to take, where I'll bring my kit, we get a place and we start putting it on YouTube. And I was like,
yeah,
okay, let's go for it. So then we've done 6 now over the last 3 months. And I think over the 6 that we've had, I think it's just gone over 1,300 views across the 6. So say about 200 each. The support that comes on the back of it, because I think you're visualizing what you can see, the emotion, the body language of the conversation, that the amount of support is just surreal. But the exposure is what's best about it, because you get people from word of mouth and people. Like, we had one lady in Australia that messaged and said, like a woman messaged and said, I've seen your podcast with Frankie. I love it. Give him my best wishes and I hope he's doing really well now. So it's like, that's what we're trying to achieve, is just the exposure and men to realize that, you know what, just because you're not all right, that is all right.
Yeah, that is all right. It's okay not to be okay. We'll finish off the podcast and we'll go back to you, even though the podcast is you. What have you learnt from some of the guests that you've had on? Some key things.
So the one thing that always stands out to me is you don't actually realize what someone's going through until you've had a conversation. Yeah. Because I've had people on that I know but never knew their story, and it instantly changes your perception of them as a person. Again, like I said, that there's so many things that fall under our mental health just because of the different subjects that have been spoken about. And the biggest thing I've learned is the moment you've spoken about it, it's probably one of the best feelings of your life, in the sense of, because some of them hadn't even spoken about it often. Yeah. Once you gather that conversation, you've spoken about it and you're going back and forth. And I think when you're speaking to people, you learn a lot as well, just from the conversation.
You do.
It's basically become more medicine, because I love learning as well. So I'm learning more about my mental health as well, because I'm gaining mechanisms and different activities that they do. And so it's always learning curve for me as well. And, you know, I just see them as conversations, not cameras, microphones. I just see them as two men sat there having a conversation about their mental health to help inspire others to do the same.
Exactly. And you're absolutely spot on with how it regulates. I'm sure it regulates your mental health just by being engaged in those conversations. And one of the questions I was going to ask you is, what do you do nowadays to, you know, avoid possibly falling back into those thought patterns, and how do you I'm sure you've grown incredibly since then. So they're not as loud as the voices, so to speak, aren't as loud as they used to be. But what sort of activities and, as you said, mechanisms do you implement in your life?
So I have a therapist now that I talk to.
Good.
Straight after I've finished podcast recordings, because the conversation has been held, I feel like it's important to not really process all that information in my mind, where you can overthink the subject and you start to feel a bit like, why did I try and take my life over lockdown? And you sort of compare, and I think, like I say, everyone has their different paths that people go through different things. So I talk to my first therapist every single time now, without fail, just so I'm not in my own thoughts. It's funny you asked me, because now, before we were recording, this is my mindfulness journal. So I've just finished today's one. So every day, every morning and every evening, I'm in the journal. First thing I wake up, I'm writing down how I'm feeling, what I want to achieve today, and then how I feel at night, how today's been, what do I want to achieve tomorrow. So I'm just keeping that feelings on a page, getting it out, in a sense of, if I'm not having a conversation about my mental health, I'm keeping a journal of it. Reading. I read now every time before I go to bed, and getting outside. Like today, even though the weather's been terrible, I took the dog out. I always try to do something. So mind, body, and soul is the three things that I live by now.
Okay.
Do something for my mind every day, reading, journaling, you know, planning ahead for future, the podcast planning, body. So whether it's going to the gym, going for a run, dog walking, and then your soul. So the journaling is probably the biggest one for my soul, because I find it quite relaxing as well. And I always have a conversation with at least one person every day. So outside of work, that is. So I'll have a conversation with my missus. I'll ring a mate up just to check in how they're doing. Because like I say, just having that conversation, it sort of takes away them negative thoughts, because you're having a conversation, and that's an opportunity for that to come into the conversation. Yeah. So I'm doing quite a fair bit, but it's not overwhelming. So that's good.
That's the main thing. And I think all the things that you sort of laid out is, in the modern era, and probably forever, to be fair, we can fool. I think if you have like quite an overactive mind, like amount of mind that thinks a lot and feels a lot, you can fall into a trap of obsessing over yourself. And I know that I do this, and I know that. And one of the best remedies for anxiety and depression actually is engaging in something other than you. Now, I would almost consider journaling the same thing, which doesn't really make any sense. But when you journal, you're kind of separating the two parts of yourself out. You're separating the erratic, anxious, end of the world, catastrophizing part of your brain with the more rational part. And they can kind of have a conversation back and forth as you're writing things out. And, you know, as you said, talking to your missus and the podcast, all these things they're about you in a sense, but they're also about other people. And if you're a person who's interested in other people, which you clearly are, and you have an overactive mind, that's an incredible outlet to make use of to keep yourself regulated and keep yourself, you know, bolstered up. So keep at it.
So, and the thing is as well, I used to, when it got to the weekend before, if I wasn't doing anything, I had to be doing something, or I felt like I was missing out and I was wasting time. Now, I actually appreciate my own time. Now I can relax and just be around myself, because I've dealt with the stuff that I had to deal with. So now I've got to the place where I'm dealing with it. Now I can actually sit there and my thoughts are more positive and they're more about the future and I just remain present. If I feel anxious, and I say this all the time on the podcast, when I feel anxious, I bring myself back to where my feet are, because we can get lost in these moments of thinking about what's happened and how we can't change it. If I did this, if I did that, this would be different, this would be different. And then we think, oh, in the future, I want this, I want that. And you start obsessing about the stuff that hasn't even come your way yet. So, and then it becomes that anxiety of, it's not here right now, so I just want it here, sort of things. And now I'm just, this is where I am. This is what I'm feeling right now and what I'm doing. Let's deal with this right now. So that's another big thing.
Bringing it, I like the way you use feet, like bringing, a therapist told this to me once. He said, a lot of like negative energy and sensation are like in the like torso and like, you know, body and head. And if you can put some attention in your legs and feet, because when you're anxious, nothing really happens there. Maybe some people get wobbly feet, but not really. So if you can put some attention in your feet and legs, then that can take some of that pressure away from how you're feeling. Like it, for me, it's my stomach. My stomach is always the thing where like I feel a lot of things going on in there. So yeah, difficult, but that's a good tip.
I just, you saying about the stomach feeling, I used to go through this phase of just feeling sick from the anxiety. It was like this, my stomach just felt really light and almost like a sinking feeling. And whereas now where I've got the coping mechanisms and I know what to do when it comes, I still have the days now where I have bad days and I feel anxious, but I've now learned coping mechanisms. So now when I feel anxious, like I say, I have this, I call it like an anchor, where if I'm sat here, I'll try and show it, but I just like rest my thumb under my finger. So if I'm feeling anxious, I just go like this. And then instantly I'm reminding myself, we feel anxious, bring yourself back to where your feet are, Jules. So it's like a physical sort of trigger for me to go, let's recognize that now and just subconsciously do what we've been learning to do.
Yeah. When my dad was a very anxious growing up, and he had an elastic band around his hand, and every time he got anxious, he would pull it and let it, he would, you know, tense it and let it go. And I think that's because we can just like, our brains can just run away with us, can't they? And it's just learning how to come back to them, not force them back into check, but control them. Right. I'm aware that you want an evening and you've probably been at work all day. So let's do the final question. What does the future hold for you? What are you hoping to achieve and where are you hoping to go in the future?
So I think if I look at the last month and what's coming for the end of this year, so the mindset event, speaking in front of 300 people and receiving messages after, 9 men message me and I'm in conversation with 9 men about their struggles and just trying to give them that support. On the back end of that, you might have seen it about that inspirational men's award that I got.
Yes, I did.
Yes. So I was awarded with that, which was quite, I was really taken back and I cried my eyes out when I had got the news. And I've been offered to go as an award recipient to the event on the 23rd. So I've got an award basically. Oh, awesome. So that's pretty surreal. And then
absolutely
that weekend I'm in Salisbury Guild Hall talking in front of 500 people about my story, what I've learned. And so I think with the podcast and the speaking that comes of it, I think my ambition and my aim alongside the United Minds is to just keep talking, get to as many places as possible where I can talk and be open, be vulnerable, and just try and inspire people that talking about it can really help you. So, yeah, I'm excited to see what the future holds. But, like I say, where my feet are, I'm just taking it every day.
100%. Take it every day it comes. Dream of the future, but focus on the day. I think that's a good sort of rule to implement. And that's what you're doing. George, thank you so much for speaking to me, man. I really appreciate it.